Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we explore different aspects of UFOs and the paranormal, and today we're going to be talking about ghosts. More specifically, the ghosts of Fort Worth in Texas. And our guest is Brian Righi. His last name is spelled R-I-G-H-I. And he has written a very interesting book called The Ghosts of Fort Worth, Exploring Cowtown's Most Haunted Locations. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Is Fort Worth haunted? Are there places you can go there to actually see a ghost? Apparently, yes. Our guest tonight has uncovered many very interesting first-hand accounts, and tonight he's going to share some of his more exciting cases, such as the Carter Ghost Town, or here's an interesting one, the Screaming Bridge. I can't wait to hear about that. Another very spooky place is the Lost Infant Cemetery. Lots of other very haunted places in Fort Worth. So this should be pretty interesting. And Righi has actually been doing this for a long time. So he's going to discuss also, hopefully, the history of ghost hunting and techniques used by ghost hunters and some of the general theories about ghosts and apparitions and poltergeists and how they're related to each other. Brian has actually been a veteran ghost hunter for years. He studied at DePaul University, where he earned degrees in sociology, English, and creative writing. And since then, he has traveled the country investigating claims of the paranormal and lecturing on his unusual experiences. He currently resides in Fort Worth, where he is studying the local folklore and paranormal happenings. And he's also a ghost tour guide, so we're talking to a real expert here tonight. He's the author of The Ghosts of Fort Worth, which has just been released by Schiffer Publishing, and he also has two upcoming books, including The Spirits of Dallas and Everything You've Ever Wanted to Know About Ghosts But Were Afraid to Ask. And I'm sure there's a lot of you out there who do have some questions, so if you'd like to call in and ask our guest a question, please feel free. This is a call-in show. There's toll-free number is 877-270-8714, so we'd love to hear from you. Let's just get to our guest, Brian. Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Preston, hi. Thank you for having me. I love your show, so it's a pleasure to be here today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, it's really fun for me to talk to all these different guests, people like you, and really explore all the subjects from, you know, the source.
Absolutely.
So I really, really enjoy it. And, wow, so ghosts, huh?
Yes, yes. Everybody loves a good ghost story, that's for sure.
Right. So did you always believe in ghosts then growing up? I mean, I was skeptical myself.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that I probably got much of it from my parents. I grew up in a household where they just loved telling ghost stories.
Oh, really?
And they spent a lot of time in Europe, in Germany especially, and they had a lot of ghost stories from over there. So I kind of grew up with the adults sitting around the kitchen table at night drinking coffee and scaring the tar out of the kids, you know.
Right. Well, I understand Europe is just thick with ghosts, England, and they all believe it over there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think as I got older, you know, my skepticism started to set in a little bit. But once I started studying the paranormal and going out on investigations and ghost hunts and whatnot, it really started to kind of change my mind about things.
Right. I don't like the term ghost believer very much anyway, or UFO believer,
mm-hmm.
because, I mean, that's not what it's about. It's about researching the evidence and trying to decide what it means.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think it means something a little bit different for each one of us.
Right, exactly. So how did it all begin? I mean, how did you go from, like, just being interested in ghosts to actually actively researching the subject?
Well, believe it or not, as mercenary as it sounds, a number of years ago, I decided that I wanted to write a really good book, and I wanted to write something that I thought would sell. So I said, you know, everybody loves ghost stories, and ghost books usually do pretty well on the shelves, so I'll take a crack at it. Now, I'd known very little about ghosts before this, other than, you know, ghost stories as a kid, of course.
Right.
And I started doing my research and learning the topic, and I just became fascinated with it. And it's one of those things that once you start up, you kind of get bitten by it. And, you know, you go from reading books about it to you know, believe it or not, spending time in cemeteries at midnight, you know, things like that.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I started out reading, next thing I know, I'm asking everyone I know, have you ever seen a ghost?
Exactly.
Start interviewing them.
And then you can't get rid of it. Like I said, it's a bug. You get bitten by it.
Right. Well, it's a good thing, though, because, I mean, it's a fascinating subject, and it's obviously real. I mean, if you do any research into this, I think it's very convincing, the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard. It's really, I mean, if you do your research, it's hard not to be convinced by it, just from the sheer volume of it. I mean, you know, we've had a, you know, mankind has had a belief in ghosts going all the way back to early Neanderthal burial practices.
Wow.
You know, they've shown that the Neanderthals buried their dead in a manner which suggested they believed in an afterlife. And more than that, in a manner in which they believe that, you know, the person might come back in some form or other.
Right, that's true. It's prevalent in pretty much all cultures, now that I think of it.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at any culture, and it has a belief in spirits of the dead returning.
Right, right.
You know, some of the cultures throughout history embraced that and used it. I mean, you know, the Romans and the Greeks and stuff were really good about that. And others, you know, came to fear it. And so it translated a lot into their customs and their cultural practices over the years.
Right. Well, it seems to me people in the past believed in ghosts a lot more than they do, perhaps, in today's modern society. I don't know if it's... People in my own family are skeptical of ghosts, even though I've done all this research.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand how people can still remain skeptical in today's day and age. I mean, on TV, they've got these shows which are showing amazing proof.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of skeptics?
Well, you know, like I said, I think everybody brings their own thing to it, and it's really something that everybody has to come to themselves. But, you know, in our society, well, in our world in general, we've kind of gotten away from the art of dying, pretty much.
Right.
You know, people, many times, in this country anyway, they die in hospital beds surrounded by tubes and doctors and strangers and stuff like that. I mean, back then, you know, when a person were to pass away, you know, they would be sequestered at home amongst, you know, family and friends who would take care of them. I mean, death was much more real to those people than I think it is for a lot of us today.
Right. Well, when my mom died, this was many, many years ago, I was very skeptical of all these subjects, ghosts, and I actually saw her ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't believe my own eyes. I just assumed I was hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, you know, I've changed my mind about it. So I can understand how powerful skepticism can be.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, I think in a case like that where you see something like that or you see a loved one, I mean, it can really make you question, you know, yourself.
Right, right.
So
what are some of the first cases you started working on? How did you go from reading about it to actually going to these places and what did you find?
Well, one of the first investigations I ever went on, I mean, I really knew nothing about, investigating the paranormal at the time. So I made a lot of mistakes in the beginning. And one of them was, there was a cemetery here in Fort Worth called Oakwood Cemetery. And there is this tale of a woman who wanders the cemetery at night in a white gown. And the tale varies between she's calling out for a lost lover or she's calling out for her children. You know, it kind of varies in that regard. But I decided to go out there at midnight one night and see for myself. And, you know, the first mistake I made was I was going alone, you know, which you should never do on an investigation. But I grabbed my flashlight, and I got one of those little cheap Walmart disposable cameras.
Right.
And I entered the cemetery, and it's a beautiful, beautiful cemetery. I mean, it's a large necropolis, it really is, with lots of mausoleums and statuary. And I remember weaving my way through the headstones. It was probably about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, when you're in a situation like that by yourself, your mind can really kind of play tricks on you.
Well, especially if you're alone.
Exactly, right. Yes. And, you know, it was a perfect night for it. You know, the moon was out and the wind was blowing a little bit through the trees, so it was pretty eerie. And I remember off in the distance, I saw something moving towards me. through the cemetery, and I kind of stopped in my tracks, and it was a white object that was coming towards me, kind of weaving its way between the tombstones, and I really had to question at that point exactly what I was doing out there, you know, because a lot of us, we want to go out and see ghosts, but it's kind of a different story once we do.
Right.
You know, are you really ready to see what you're looking for? So this thing got closer and closer and closer, and I really didn't know what to do. And it just started kind of gliding up towards me. And
wow.
When it got, I would say 20, 30 yards away from me, it bellowed out in this horrible sound. And
you're kidding.
I just started laughing because it was a cow.
Huh.
And it moved out, and when it heard me laughing, it got scared, and it took off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, to the cemetery. So, you know, I don't know who had the bigger heart attack, me or the cow that night, but that was my first introduction, you know, to ghost hunting.
Right. You know, it's funny. I have a similar story that happened to me and my brother,
uh-huh.
which is also kind of amusing. We're driving through Georgia late at night, driving across the country with my other brothers and sisters who were asleep in the car,
uh-huh.
and we pulled over to, you know, do our business, relieve ourselves,
uh-huh.
and we walked off into these deep, dark woods, and we're about to do it when we realized we were in the middle of a cemetery, an old abandoned graveyard, and we were looking down, it was Mary Jennings' grave, and we're like, no, we're not going to do this here, so we each separated, right, and
yeah.
walked into the forest, and suddenly I hear my brother scream out bloody murder, and he's running back to the car at top speed. And I zip up my pants, and I run back, and he's in the car saying, ghost, ghost, a ghost. I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, we went back outside. It turned out he had stepped into a barbed wire fence, and it ripped his shirt right off his back without him realizing how it happened. And he just was sure it was a ghost.
Uh-huh.
So it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah, those
you can't
those,
be too careful.
Those things happen on in investigations, and, you know, the spice of life, I guess. I mean, I almost got sprayed one time by a skunk in a very similar situation. So it wasn't pretty.
Well, there are dangers. Well, cemeteries, though, they are very haunted, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the places that you can go to, I mean, cemeteries seem to definitely have ghosts.
Well, a lot of people would say that because, you know, it's a highly concentrated area where there's a lot of bodies at. And, you know, there are a lot of theories associated behind portal hauntings and stuff like that. And one of them is that there are certain portals into our material world and to our dimension.
Right.
In which spirits can pass back and forth. And, you know, subconsciously, we kind of recognize these areas of high-intensity energy. And so we put our churches there, we put our cemeteries there, put places of great importance to us, and they act as a nodule between, you know, this world and the next, where spirits can kind of come and go.
Right, the veil between the worlds.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of the theories. Another is that, you know, a lot of cultures believe that, you know, the spirit kind of hung around attached to the body for a certain period of time after death.
Well, I know there's a lot of cemeteries that have reputations for, you know, ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Back in Eastern states, the New England states, there's a lot of activity there in cemeteries. And I mean, Forest Lawn here in Southern California, mm-hmm. there's a lot of accounts here. I talked to one lady who had a friend who was a truck driver, and he had heard about this ghost in Forest Lawn and this particular mausoleum. He was skeptical, and so he went there with the guy who knew about the ghost, and this ghost actually did appear and came and out and attacked them. And they went running away screaming.
Wow.
So I do think that there is some truth to, you know, ghosts hanging around in these areas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, and, you know, it seems like most cemeteries have a story behind them.
Right.
So I know there's one here in the Fort Worth area that's really known for, you know, having a high concentration of ghosts in it or you know, paranormal happenings, and it's called Veal Station Cemetery. And the legend is that if you go there at night and look out into the cemetery, you'll see this glowing tombstone.
Oh, really?
And it really does glow. You can go out to the cemetery and see this tombstone going, but it really has some natural explanations behind it, I believe. However, when you're out there in the cemetery, it's one of those old country cemeteries, especially here in Texas, that give you a really creepy feeling.
Right.
And that is the cemetery where I experienced my first cold spot, which was really interesting.
Oh, tell us about that. That sounds interesting.
Well, I was going through the cemetery, and I was doing research for the location for a book. And I was there at night trying to find this tombstone that was supposed to be going. And you can see it from the road. You can see it going from the road, but the closer you get, the more it diminishes. Until by the time you get all the way back to the cemetery where it's at, you can't tell which one had been glowing anymore. But I was walking to the cemetery, and it was probably, you know, July night in Texas, which is really hot. And just walk along, and suddenly I just walked right into this bone-chilling cold spot. And, I mean, this is just not something you mistake for anything else. You don't forget one of these. It seems to just, like, penetrate you.
Was that dramatic?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And I walked into it, and I walked out of it, so it had a particular diameter to it. And I turned, and I took a photograph of it. And in the photograph, there was this white kind of column of misty-shaped like thing in it, which you couldn't see with the naked eye, but it came up on the digital photograph.
Why do you suppose photographs sometimes are able to capture things the naked eye can't see?
Well, you know, photographs work entirely different than, you know, human vision, of course. And there's a lot of theories as to why. One of them is simply that, you know, the brain processes thousands of millions of bits of pieces of stimuli that come into it. It kind of forms this picture of our reality. And the mind has filters on it because it can only let in so much. It has to be able to tell what to exclude and what not to. And a lot of those filters are kind of, you know, conditioned into us as we grow up. And, you know, we're really told what to see and what not to see.
Right.
Until, you know, we're adults, our idea of reality is pretty solidified.
Right. Well, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, that's exactly sort of what happened to me when I saw a ghost. It didn't even occur to me that it was a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and a lot of times when people see a ghost or some other type of manifestation, they're kind of in a state of mind where they're not paying attention to what's going on. Like, they'll see it out of the corner of their eye, or they'll be half awake, or they'll be deep in thought about something else, to the point to where, you know, those filters are kind of down a little bit. Well, you know, cameras and stuff don't have those kind of filters on them. So I think sometimes they tell us the truth a little bit more than what we can see.
Right.
So, I mean, and take children, for example. I mean, you know, when we were kids, we had imaginary friends, you know, and that was in an age when, you know, the world was much more open to us, and we hadn't formed a perfect sense of reality yet. So, you know, the question then becomes, you know, how many of those friends were our imagination and how many were something that we were seeing?
Right. Well, I've talked to a lot of, I mean, I've investigated some cases where only the kids could see the ghosts.
Yeah, absolutely, and many times for that reason, that type of activity is drawn to the children in an area that there's haunting.
Well, get this, you know, I've interviewed lots of people about ghosts and UFOs, and with UFOs, I did a survey about all the people I've interviewed. It's evenly split between men and women who've seen them. But I did the same survey with all the people I've interviewed who've seen ghosts, and I found twice as many women than men.
Yes.
So, have you had that experience, or what do you think about that?
I have, and you know, one of the things I know is that there are probably twice as many women involved in ghost hunting as there are men.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, really. Wow. I mean, my publisher was telling me that their target audience for their books on the paranormal are women.
Wow.
Between, I think it was like 35 and 55.
Isn't that interesting?
It is, and yeah, I don't know why, you know, women are more drawn to it and men aren't.
well, they're seeing these things, and men aren't for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they're more intuitive, or there's something about the biological. I don't know. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, it absolutely could be. You know, women are. And I know I said the wrong thing here.
I'm
gonna get myself in trouble. But you know, well, women might be genetically be predispositioned towards paying attention to things better. You know, when it comes to child care and stuff like that.
Right.
And I've seen studies where, you know, they took the woman's ability to notice things for their child and the man's ability to notice things with his child. And, you know, the mother picked up on all the subconscious little signals that the baby was giving off. That maybe women are just biologically, you know, predispositioned towards being a little more sensitive to things, or, like you said, intuitive.
Right. Well, it is definitely a prominent pattern, which... is there. I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's so obvious to me that...
And you know, too, I mean, you know, perhaps, in our society anyway, men are told that those kind of things, as they're growing up, are nonsense.
Right. They're not logical.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, we're told as men that we have to be logical and rational and things like that, and that just doesn't fit in with the grand scheme of ghosts, so... maybe that's why men have a harder time experiencing or seeing those kind of things.
Right.
And two, maybe men, you know, feel a little bit more self-conscious about reporting those kind of things.
Right, I can see that.
You know, out of fear of ridicule for their experience.
That's unfortunate, because this is a subject, I think, that the evidence for it is growing each day.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, once you start getting hooked into it, you're sort of hooked into it for forever.
Absolutely.
So the audience of people is growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
to this subject.
Oh, yeah. And you know, you can see that in the ghost hunting movement. There's so many people getting involved in it nowadays. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, greater exposure in the media. You know, shows like your own and shows like Taps or some of the more, you know, some of the television shows.
Right.
You know, are getting a lot of exposure to it. People love it. They're just really getting into it.
Right. Well, in books like The Ghosts of Fort Worth, I mean, finally people are specializing in all these areas. So it's,
yeah,
really interesting. I mean, like, what's the Screaming Bridge? So that sounds interesting.
Screaming Bridge is an area in just outside of Fort Worth in Arlington. And if you can picture it, you have Fort Worth to the west, and you have... the mid-cities, and then you have Dallas to the east, and they make one, they've grown into one another, so they're like one giant metroplex. But in the mid-cities area, to the north of that, there is an old country road that once had a bridge that ran across it, a wooden bridge, and the road was called Old Harrison Road at the time. But they called it the Screaming Bridge because the boys would like to take the girls out there at night. And they would drive across this bridge as fast as they could. And because it was so old, the weight of the tires and stuff would make the bridge kind of groan and squeal out, really, as they zipped across it as fast as they could. And that's how it got the name Screaming Bridge. It was an area in Mosier Valley was the exact area. But back in the 1870s, what had happened was you had a group of freed slaves from the Mosier Plantation that kind of developed a close-knit farming community on one side, in the Trinity River bottomland, and then you had more of the white settlement on the other side. And, you know, tensions kind of built until about the 1960s when, in an act of vandalism, some of the local white high school boys went out there and burned the bridge down.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and... So then the railroad, they put up these barriers to warn vehicles that the bridge was out. And 2 weeks later, somebody went out and stole all the barriers and the signs. So I think it was a Saturday night in February 1961. There was a carload of teenage girls that were driving back home from Fort Worth after seeing a movie. And it was a cold, foggy, rainy night. And they went down that road to take a shortcut, and they didn't know the bridge was out because the signs had been removed. And their car flew off of the bridge and into the embankment, and there were six girls in there, and three of them died on impact, and the other three had to be taken to the hospital. And then probably, so they shut that area down after that, but they opened it up a short time later, and I think it was about 10 years later, another group of girls was driving through that crossing, because the bridge crossed a set of railroad tracks, and another group of girls were going through there late at night after a Halloween party, and they were struck by a train that was going through the area, and several of them died as well. Well, everybody that was in the truck, but there was a couple of them that were in there. And since then, you know, local legend kind of built on these deaths over and over again, and these urban legends developed about, if you go to the bridge on midnight on the anniversary of their death and you sit there and wait, a fog will come up from the river below, and you'll see the headlights of a car coming towards you, and right before the car gets ready to hit you, it'll disappear. And then you'll hear screams down in the embankment. Well, it kind of follows a general pattern of urban legends that you find on a lot of bridges. But what they had done was they had taken the bridge out entirely, and they created this kind of dirt embankment. And we started going out there. We started researching it through local newspaper clippings and stuff, and we found the actual site of the bridge.
Oh, wow.
We started doing investigations out there, and we actually went out there with a local news team close to Halloween 2 years ago. And it was really great because they were interviewing us out there. And while they were interviewing one of the members of the group that I was with, they're asking her questions. And in the background, you suddenly heard this voice kind of chattering away. And the cameraman stopped and the news anchor stopped because there was nobody there. But it was like the sound was coming directly from behind the person that they're interviewing.
Huh.
And since we've been out there, we've captured photographic anomalies, orbs and mist and things like that. And we had a night vision camera set up on a group that was doing EVP, which is electronic voice phenomena.
Yeah, that's bizarre. I've heard some very interesting stuff there.
Yeah, and they were conducting one of those with an audio recorder. And I remember I was at the camera. And the camera was a digital camera with a night vision on it. And I just watched as this pulsing orb came down about head level, circled the group kind of slowly, and then shot straight up into the air.
Wow.
So it was pretty fascinating.
Now, this was an orb that was clearly visible?
This, not to the naked eye, but only on the camera.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and the night shot, and the night vision.
Okay.
And we've had a lot of electromagnetic disturbances out there, and we use EMF meters to measure electromagnetic fields.
Right.
And we've had the arms for the train tracks come down by themselves.
Really?
When there was no train coming through, and just a number of things. It's a really interesting sight. And they called it a screaming bridge, but they also called it Death Crossing.
For obvious reasons.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So it's a pretty fascinating place to spend time at.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Well, everyone, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. And tonight, our guest is Brian Righi. That's R-I-G-H-I. And he's written a fascinating book called Ghosts of Fort Worth, Exploring Cowtown's Most Haunted Locations, which has just been released by Schiffer Books. So people can get this book, I'm assuming, on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you have a website or an email or anything you'd like to give out?
Yes, they can go to dfwghosthunters.com.
dfwghosthunters.com. That's D as in David?
Yes.
Okay. So what's on the website? You're actually a ghost tour guide, right?
Yes, that's correct. It's the website for the group that I belong to, and if they want to contact me directly, you know, we have a members profile section, and they can go to that and read my profile, and they can email me. There'll be a link to email me from there.
Well,
But we started doing tours of places like Screaming Bridge and Carter Ghost Town and the Lost Cemetery, Lost Infant Cemetery, for the public.
Oh, that's great. I mean, because people are, I mean, these are pretty popular. The ghost tours are really popular.
Oh, absolutely. They're more than what we can keep up with.
Really?
They really are. We started off and, you know, we have a tour section on the website that they can go to also, but we started off and we put the information up there and we got flooded with requests for tours.
Wow, so how long have you been doing these tours?
We've been doing the tours for probably about 3 years now.
Wow. So have you seen stuff during any of these tours or with people?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the attractions for us is getting new people out there because, you know, there's an energy or a vibe that different people carry with them. And it's great to see people out there and excited and experiencing things. And sometimes you get somebody out there and they'll just bring the ghosts out.
Right. Well, I think the ghosts are they are aware, I think, of what's going on around them.
Absolutely.
And so they will manifest, you know, on purpose to either scare people or impress them or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes, and, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, ghosts are attracted to certain types of people.
Right, like the ones who looked like the person they lost or looking for or whatever.
Sure, it could be you know, some physical characteristic that they're attracted to, or it could be an emotional one.
Right.
You know, perhaps there's something about that person that reminds them of themselves. Or maybe there's something that they want to experience by being around that person that will draw them to them. I mean, people can be just as haunted as locations can.
Wow. So, I mean, this brings up the subject of poltergeists. Mm-hmm. And are poltergeists the same thing as ghosts, do you think?
Well, you know, historically, poltergeists have been labeled a lot of different things. You know, initially, they were labeled demons, the work of witches. And it's kind of interesting if you look back at some of the witch trials in history and you look at the things that the witches were being accused of, you know, stones being thrown, objects moving, fire starting on their own. And you see this pattern that really kind of correlates to poltergeist activity.
Wow.
And it's almost sad to think that, you know, possibly there was this some poor soul that was being terrorized by a poltergeist and was accused of being a witch for it.
Right, you know, right. No doubt that has happened. I mean, there's a long history of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, with our perception of the spirit world changing, you know, so has, you know, what we thought poltergeists are. You know, the big thing nowadays among parapsychologists is repressed psychokinetic energy. And that is, since poltergeist activity seems to center around an individual as opposed to a location, they believe that individual, which they term the focus or the agent of the poltergeist infestation, is actually subconsciously causing the behavior themselves.
Right. Well, I wonder if these agents are just people who have some mediumistic powers and poltergeist is just sort of uncontrolled mediumship.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's kind of my favorite theory right now.
Uh-huh.
And I don't really favor the demonic theory, even though I think that there's some impressive... I mean, they can march out their evidence, and it makes you wonder sometimes whether demons are real. But
uh-huh.
Hans Holzer, he's a really famous ghost hunter, and he says he's never encountered anything like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Ed and Lorraine Warren, you've heard of them?
Uh-huh, yeah.
But they say, yes, demons are real. They've certainly got a lot of cases they've worked on.
They do, and I don't know. It's strange, you know. Ed and Lorraine are Catholics,
right?
And I'm a Catholic myself, and you know, it's kind of a Catholic mindset to believe in that. You know, so I grew up believing that, you know, demons existed and they could, you know, interact with people. But Hans isn't. I don't think he comes from that mindset. So it's kind of interesting to see how people take an experience and see it different ways.
Right, because clearly they're investigating the same types of cases.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, and where at one hand, Hans sees, you know, a poltergeist or a ghost, you know, Ed and Lorraine see a demon.
Right. Well, I know they, Edmund and Lorraine Warren, have actually classified some human beings as becoming demonic. So I don't know where you draw the line between a non-human spirit, so to speak, and a human one then.
Yeah, yeah. Right? Well, you know, I think that when, you know, a person passes over, they pretty much stay the same in the sense of their personality. So if a ghost is going to stick around, if it was the ghost of a good person, you know, I think it's going to be a good ghost.
Right.
If it was the ghost of a bad, violent person, then it's going to be a bad, violent ghost.
Right. Well, this is the whole theory about why you shouldn't use a Ouija board, right?
Yes.
Because the lowest astral plane is just teeming with all the drug users and,
mm-hmm.
and the murderers and rapists. And
all the base spirits.
Right. So do you think that that's true?
I don't know. You know, my problem with, you know, Ouija boards are, number one, you can't really validate anything that's going on.
Right.
And number two, you know, you're actually physically using your body as a conduit between the material and the spiritual world.
Right. I've done it, actually. I did some table lifting with a medium.
Uh-huh.
So I felt this energy, actually.
Yes, yes. And that, that always kind of, you know, worries me a little bit, you know, when a spirit is actually able to manifest itself through you.
Right. Well, this is how a lot of hauntings, people, I'd say about a quarter or maybe a little bit less of the hauntings I've investigated have actually started, mm-hmm. because of a Ouija board.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, people think it's a game, you know, it was marketed by Parker Brothers.
Right.
You know?
Well, it is just a board, after all. I mean,
yeah.
Right? I mean, the board itself is not carrying any special energy.
No. No, I mean, it's just a board with it's just a painted board, and you know, you have your oracle or your Plushante or whatever you're using.
Right. In fact, the people I talked to who had a really bad haunting made their own Ouija board out of paper.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it can be made out of anything, and there are lots of different, you know, forms of Ouija boards, but you know, I think what it all boils down to is that you're actively inviting something into your environment, and you don't always know what's coming through.
Right.
So.
And they'll take on any label you give them, it seems like.
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, you know, if they have malicious intent or, you know, a hidden agenda of some kind, they're going to say whatever they think they need to say or they want to say.
Is that you, Ma? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, of course it's me. I mean, so you don't know what's coming through, and that's a problem for me. I don't like uncontrolled situations like that.
All right. Well, that's what's fascinating about this whole field of study is it's really open for study. We really don't know a lot about it.
Uh-huh.
And I think we're making great strides just recently with all this technology that we're applying to it and all this attention. But still, I have lots of questions. Like, one I want to ask you, which has always puzzled me, is, you know, ghosts don't appear naked. They appear with their clothes. I can accept that, but what about, like, ghostly cars and, like you mentioned, ghostly headlights and ghost horses, people? I mean, what is happening in these situations? Is that a real haunting or is that a residual type of thing where people are looking through time into the past somehow?
Well, once again, there's a lot of theories. You know, this is a field that you take one thing and there are 10 or 20 theories about that one thing.
Frustrating.
There are a lot of ideas behind it. You know, there's a long history of phantom trains, boats, planes, cars, horses, stagecoaches, a lot of in-it houses.
Right.
Even.
Well,
and, you know, they've been classified as residual hauntings, which are, you know, impressions left on the environment. And then when the conditions are exactly right, that energy is released again, kind of like a tape being played over and over again or skipping.
Right.
And you see the manifestation of whatever it may be. There's also theories about, you know, the telepathic nature of a person dying. You know, a person died in a car. You know, they leave this telepathic impression based on kind of like their mindset, which is entirely different than sounds a lot like a residual impression. Whereas a residual impression is energy, a telepathic impression is more like the last instant of a person's life, and so they telepathically relive that.
Right, right. And this is what psychics, I think, pick up on a lot of times.
Exactly.
That blast of energy.
And you know, I mean, the mind is an incredible thing. I mean, the Buddhists believe in what they call tulpas. And a tulpa is a phantom created through mental projection.
Oh, right. I've heard of this. Yeah.
Yes.
A thought form, sort of.
Thought forms, exactly. And, you know, when a person's mind is strong enough, or, let's say, a traumatic incident is strong enough, you know, it can impress that thought form into the environment. There's a very famous woman by the name of Alexandra David Neal.
Right.
And back in, I think it was the 20s, the 1920s, somewhere around there, she had went to Tibet, and she was the first woman to actually enter the Forbidden City. And in her writings, she talks about sitting down and creating a tulpa through this long, drawn-out mental process that she learned from the Buddhist monks. And so they're traveling along after she's been working on this tulpa in the evenings when she's had time to rest. And suddenly this monk joins the caravan that nobody's seen. And he interacts with her, and he interacts, I believe, with one other person in the group, but nobody else can see the monk.
Wow.
And over time, the monk begins as this very helpful, kind of jolly fellow, but then it suddenly turned malicious over time until she then had to spend the time to reverse the process and dispel the tulpa. And that comes from her writings.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm actually... I've heard of the story before. It's very interesting.
And
clearly, the human mind or whatever has abilities we've only begun to tap into.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, and you know that might be part of this haunting of inanimate objects. I mean, there's stories about people that have traveled down a road, in the evening and seen a house with the lights on and smoke coming out of the chimney, and the next day gone back in the same direction and there was nothing there. It had all been, hallucination, a mirage, an apparition.
Well, one story I read, which, I don't know, it's, for some reason it just sticks in my mind, was about a lady who went to a hotel, and she was staying in the room, and she opened the closet door to put her coat away, and there was a man hanging to death. He had hung himself in the closet. And she slammed the door closed and went running down to the front desk. And she was livid. She was very angry. She says, "How could you possibly rent me this room where there is a man in the closet hanging dead?"
Mm-hmm.
And the clerk turned pale. He's like, "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry." And they went up to the room and they opened the closet and there was nothing there. And the lady was like, "Oh, my God." And the clerk explained, "I'm really sorry. This happened yesterday, actually. The guy hung himself just earlier." And it must have left such a huge impression psychically or somehow that she saw it vividly as if it was really there.
Yeah, we, not too long ago, DFW Go Center is the group that I'm a member of, we had an investigation at a hotel in Dallas called Hotel Lawrence. And it's this big, beautiful 10-story hotel from 1925, I think, when it was built. And on the 10th floor in the presidential suite, one of the guests had killed themselves. They have a lot of activity in that hotel.
Huh.
And we did an investigation there, and we had set up our equipment. We had set up our audio tapes, our audio recorders, and our cameras, and we had an EMF meter laying on the bed. And we were trying to do some EVP, and suddenly the EMF meter started spiking. It started going off, and when it does, it sends off this loud alarm. And one of the investigators had bent over the bed with his hands behind his back because he was laying on the bed, and he was just kind of reading off the numbers to me as I was jotting them down. And, right before all of us, the EMF meter moved by itself across the bed probably, 3 or 4 inches.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not a great deal of space, but just enough that, it really gave us a start. It was both exciting and a little shocking at the same time.
A little. Now just back up a second. How is this happening, do you think? Is this a ghost picking it up?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I mean, how is a supposedly immaterial being affecting the physical environment?
Well, you know, there's a lot of cases where, you know, objects have moved. Objects have been hurled at people.
Right. Ghosts are clearly able to do this. I mean, they open and close doors.
Yes.
And they push people downstairs and tug people's hair. But I'm just, I'm wondering how.
Yeah. It's difficult to say. I mean, I wish I had an answer for that.
Well, we can only speculate at this point, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, somehow, to some degree, they are able to interact with the physical environment. Now, usually it's very minimal. Like you said, you know, a door open and shut.
I think it's a big deal for a ghost when they're able to do something like that.
I do too, and you know, they probably, if we were just to kind of throw something out and theorize about it, they probably expend a great deal of energy doing that. It's interesting because in hauntings like the Enfield haunting in England, which is also called the Enfield poltergeist case.
Oh, right, I remember that.
When some reporters went in there from one of the English stations, and they reported that they had little toys hurled at them, Lincoln Logs, Legos, that kind of thing. And when they picked up those objects that had been moved afterwards, they were really hot to the touch.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
As if there was some form of energy transference that had occurred in order to get that object to move from one place to another.
Right. Well, I've had out-of-body experiences in the past, and I always try and move physical objects, and I'm never able to.
Uh-huh.
So I can understand that frustration, but I know there's a way to do it because other astral travelers have actually been able to move objects.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of stepping down your vibration somehow, which is all really kind of advanced and beyond me, but it's very interesting.
So some can, by conscious effort.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are ports, too, which is when the spirit actually makes the object disappear entirely.
That's right.
And, there are a lot of investigations that have been on. People have reported that things disappear and that, you know, several days later they would suddenly reappear somewhere that they know that they had looked or...
Right. Well, it makes you wonder where these objects are during this absence, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does. I mean, you know, has the spirit, you know, taken an object and transported it into the dimension that it belongs to? Or has it just moved it, you know, to some other location, like, say, in the house and hidden it and then moved it back? I don't know.
Well, there's clearly a connection between these physical and non-physical worlds. I mean, one lady, she had a haunted house. Or she didn't know she was in a haunted house, but she kept finding sequins everywhere, these sparkly sequins. It turned out that the former owner was a go-go dancer or something like that. I don't have the story exactly straight, but she wore these costumes that involved these sequins. And she would find them in the most unusual and obvious locations. I mean, right in the middle of the bathroom floor and stuff where it just could not appear.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there's a similar case to that. It was really interesting. It's pretty popular. It's the Birdcage Theater in Tombstone, Arizona.
Oh, really?
And if you've never been to Tombstone, that's a really neat place. And the Birdcage Theater used to be an old gambling hall, bordello, that kind of thing. And the owner that occupies it now, he kept finding poker chips, old-time poker chips. And just like in weird areas, they would just be on the table one day right in front of him. So he collected these things and he placed them in a lockbox. And he called some authorities in to examine the poker chips. And when the authorities got there, he opened the lockbox. So the story goes, and the chips were gone. So the authorities left, and he went to his writing desk and sat down to do some work, and he opened up a drawer, and the chips were sitting there in the drawer waiting for him.
So the ghost did not want them examined.
No, and don't you, you know, you've been on investigations before.
Sure.
And you've read a lot of the literature. I mean, don't you find it odd how there's almost like a purposeful effort on the part of spirits not to get caught?
Right. I've noticed that. It's like that with the whole UFO phenomenon, a lot of the whole paranormal phenomena seems to leave just a little bit of ambiguity there, or just almost like a cover-up.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost like they have this rule in the ghost world that you can't get caught or you're in trouble.
Right, yeah. But there are cases where ghosts are just really blatant, and everyone's seeing them, and they're talking to people. I mean, that's what's your book, Ghosts of Fort Worth. We've talked about most of the... I mean, what about, like, haunted hotels? Would you say that there's a lot of haunted hotels?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, if you take a hotel that's been around for any amount of time, and you think about the number of people that pass through there on a night, you know, multiply that by the number of years that it's been around, and you have this, you know, this huge source of energy, emotion, human drama that goes through there.
Right.
You know, people get married and they spend their honeymoons there. People fight and they get hotel rooms. People commit suicide in them. A lot of things happen in hotel rooms.
It's very interesting because it does seem that there's a lot of haunted hotels.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I mean, they end up being just like giant spiritual batteries, I guess.
Wow.
They soak up all this energy. You know, I mean, if you compare it to a house where, let's say, one group of people lives in there for 10 years, and you take a hotel where, you know, thousands of people have gone through in that same period of time, you know, it shows you the difference.
Right. So your book, Ghosts of Fort Worth, does that cover, like, private haunted houses, or is it just, like, public places where people can visit and stuff like that?
There are several houses in the book that are private residences, and... With each location, I listed all the contact information, you know, address, phone number, website, that kind of thing. So if other readers wanted to go and investigate the places themselves or visit them, they can really easily. Now, there are several houses, private residences in the book, and I didn't list that information because I didn't want to, you know, cause any problems for the proprietors of the house.
All right.
There's only two private residences in the book.
So I think it's important for people to know, though, that a lot of these houses that they're living around are having a lot of activity. I don't think people realize how common ghostly activity is.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the chapters in the book is about this building called the Schoonover Mansion, and it just looks like your normal, average, nice house. I mean, you pass it every day on your way to work, and you would never tell the difference, but a lot of stuff has gone on over the years in that place. And just by, you know, just walking by it, you wouldn't think that.
Wow.
So, you know, the house next door to you could be haunted. You never know.
That's true. Well, Brian, our hour is almost up. We have, like, 3 minutes.
Okay.
Is there anything we haven't talked about, or anything you really want to leave people with a message about ghosts and, you know, what they should do if they see one or that sort of thing?
Well, you know, ghosts aren't really, I mean, you don't find too many malicious ghosts. Usually if you see a ghost, then the ghost wants you to see them, and there's a reason for that, I think. You know, I really love the story behind ghosts. When we go out to these locations, the most exciting thing for me is learning all about that location and that story. You know, ghosts are people. I think when dealing with them, we have to treat them as such.
That's exactly what I tell people. Why would you be scared of ghosts if they're just people?
Because they were somebody's mother, grandmother, father, brother.
Right, exactly.
So.
Well, it's very interesting. I want to thank you very much for being on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it a great deal.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and let me know when your other books come out, What the Spirits of Dallas and Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Ghosts But Were Afraid to Ask. Great title.
Thank you.
And I'll definitely have you back on the show.
That would be great. I'd love that.
Awesome. Well, that's our show for today, guys. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest today has been Brian Righi, R-I-G-H-I. He's written a book called Ghosts of Fort Worth. Now, do you want to give out your website real quick again? Or?
Yes, that's dfwghosthunters.com.
D as in David and F as in Frank?
Yeah, D, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, dfghosthunters.com?
DFW.
DFW.
Yes, it stands for Dallas Fort Worth.
Oh, okay, Dallas Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. All right. Awesome. Well, guys, I hope you've enjoyed the show tonight. Next week, our guest is going to be Jim Mars, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Side Spies. So I hope you all can join us, and thanks again for listening, and I hope you can join us next week. Until then, keep your eyes to the skies, and watch out for those ghosts, too.